Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap on October the 4th of 2017. I am Nick. This is... Wait. Where is he?
Oh,
where'd he go?
I'm in your house, Nick. How terrified would you be if you turned your shoulder over and I was right behind you and all the computer technical issues were just a ruse?
To cover up your approach.
I'm like, I'm actually in your house, Nick. I never left.
The call is coming from inside the house. The Skype call.
I never left Florida. Now, I can't get my camera to work with our fucking audio board, which, if that sounds to you like that's the most horseshit excuse in the history of excuses, trust me, I don't get it either, but... That's apparently how this works. I don't know.
I'm probably going to finish recording this episode and literally 5 minutes later, oh, that's how I fixed it or something like that.
I wish. I did all of the things that I thought were the obvious solutions. I was like, oh, I just need to disable my mic and that'll do it. And it didn't. And I was like, well, maybe if I just do this, well, that'll do it. No.
Oh, well.
I'm just going to keep getting incrementally more vicious and, savage in my attempts for a solution until I eventually just sacrifice a child.
Oh, that sounds like a good way to solve your problems.
Yes.
I think that we should try that, and maybe in the course of sacrificing the child, we should plant some sort of alien symbiote on their head.
Maybe something that looks like a helmet.
Like a helmet. Cute helmet. It's got the vaguely frog-like that has cute little wings on it. Until everything becomes horrifying.
Yeah, exactly. Why does that sound so familiar?
I don't know. Anyway, unrelated topic. It is Halloween month here on Weekly Manga Recap for the entire month of October. We will be taking your Halloween-related manga suggestions for the recommendations each week. Well, hopefully each week. We'll see how long it takes us to get through some of these. And the first series that we're going to be talking about is a manga called Alien 9, which is a series about a group of little girls who become, a squad of alien capturers, I guess you could call them. And they accomplish this because they have these little tiny alien things called Borg, which they bond with by putting them on their heads, and then they get a couple of kind of parasite-esque powers from them. That's really all you can say about it without immediately getting into spoiler territory.
Well, it's hard not to get into spoiler territory because this isn't a particularly long series.
It's not. It's only about 30 chapters.
Yeah, so. I think 3 volumes, and then there's 4 volumes that came out afterwards as some kind of sequel series. I didn't read that portion of it.
Neither did I.
But there's also, I believe, a 4-episode or 4-part OVA anime version of it that you can also check out. But it's not a particularly long series. It goes relatively quickly. And because of that, there is a bit of a pacing rush where a lot of things happen and, there's a ton of content for those 30 chapters.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of time to particularly dwell on any one part of it for too long. Which could be good or bad depending on how you feel about the series, but ultimately it's sort of this sci-fi, somewhat like body horror sort of series.
A little bit.
Feels a little bit like Parasite, obviously, just from the idea of friendly symbiotes and that sort of thing. But also feels a little bit like, and I can't remember the name of it, the Maho Shoujo, not of the end, but the one that was actually a shoujo magic girl series that turned out to everyone was dying and everything. Madoka Magica,
yeah.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like that, and that it kind of sets itself up one way. And then just slowly.
Also,
you're
lesbians, happens too. So.
Exactly. Shockingly, the character called Yuri ends up with a pseudo lesbian relationship.
It's a little obvious, honestly. Rather on the nose.
So it's somewhat interesting, though, in the fact that even though it feels like those series, it never is quite as cruel as those series are. Despite the fact that there's some pretty bleak things happening, it doesn't the series doesn't hammer you over the head with them nearly as much as those sorts of series did. You know, when little girls get their limbs cut off here, you don't have to sit there for a while. And it's like the mangaka is telling you, like, look at you looking at these mutilated girls. It's like, eh, that'll be all right.
this is the attitude the girls themselves take on it, really. Because there are certain points where there's a real feeling of despair, but it's kind of saved for like points towards like the finale and times of distress and stuff like that. When it gets to the point of the aftermath, a lot of the time it's not so much, oh, I've got something bad happened to me and I'm going to just be very sad about it for a full chapter. It's weird because literally characters like get their arms ripped off and their stomach eaten by aliens and stuff like that. They're just kind of like, my arm got ripped off. My stomach got eaten by aliens. I don't like this. This sucks.
Dang it. My summer vacation's ruined. It's interesting. There's essentially three girls who make up the cast. I apologize. I had all these notes up before fourth computer crashes ago and lost it. Yuri Kumi, I think it is, and Kasumi?
Yes.
Okay. You're all going to be seeing that nonsense stuff played up there. Yumi, Kasumi, and Kumi. Essentially, all three of them have their own, like, weird, like, aspect to them. Now, Yuri is this girl who is a complete just coward. Like, she's somewhat specific in the sense that you can, like, gauge a level of, like, relatability to the fact. Because you have to recognize these are 9, 10-year-olds, like, or 9/10-year-olds here. Like, they're 10-year-old girls during this series. So the fact that one of them is pretty scared at the idea of, like, I have to hunt aliens is not that surprising.
No.
But the other two have their shit together so much more that she just sticks out like a sore thumb because she is constantly terrified. From beginning to end of the series, she is terrified of everything. But the other two girls, Kubi, who's sort of like the mature one of the group, she ends up, and again, it's hard not to spoil this series, so somewhat spoilers here, guys. She ends up essentially fusing with the creature on her head more than the others do, essentially as a sense of necessity. And because of that, she ends up becoming this sort of hybrid who is at one point like has to say like, oh, so I'm not even human anymore. And you'd be like, wow, you're really going to dwell in this, aren't you? It's like, nah, it comes up like 2 more times. And otherwise she just kind of accepts it and moves on. Like it's there, but just not dwelled upon. Like this isn't a series that hangs so much in the balance. And then the third one is Kasumi, who's like this ultra mega talented girl who they kind of, the other two girls look at as like, wow, she's meant for this. She wants to do this. You know, she's so amazing. And I've initially got the impression like, there's supposed to be something behind that. And I think there still is, but I don't know because like 2 chapters after she's introduced, she gets swallowed by an alien who imprints on her. And basically she's dead from that point onward. And it's just another alien kind of approximating her somewhat. Like she's still kind of alive, but nah, I don't know.
It's still her, but she essentially has this other alien kind of occupying her mind. And its personality can come out if provoked. It's still her, but it's also, she's changed by it, the experience.
Yeah, because the moment she comes out, she talks to her Borg. And the Borgs are supposed to have like an innately strong connection with their hosts, because of the fact that like, they literally feed off your sweat and things like that, and they bond with you. And the moment she comes out and talks to her Borg's like, you're not Kasumi, which kind of like is what gives you like the implication. It's like she's not ever fully going to be Kasumi again. And that's basically it for that part of her character, because from then forward, her story is just the fact that she is not, like she is imprinted upon by this other alien. And that's really it. Like there was this whole somewhat like small plot of like maybe being lonely, her older brother leaving, just aspects of that to just, fuck it. She's a yellow knife alien now too, or something like that. And you're like, okay, I mean, that's fine.
All three of the girls have their own kind of motivations as they're part of the squad. The what is it, the Alien Club, I think that they're called.
Yeah.
It's really weird. We'll get into the bizarreness of the setting in a little bit, but basically each of these girls, I think that each of them are nominated from a different class as the representative of that class.
Yes, they all go to the same school, I believe, but...
They all go to the same school, and each of them have to join this program, where I think that the idea is that one girl from each of the classes at the school in their year has to join it. So you've got Kumi, who wanted to do this because it's basically her way of having to get away from being Miss Perfect all the time. She says that she's always elected as class president and stuff, and she's like, I'm sick of people, you know, like, weighing me down and just rely on me to do things, and if I'm part of this weird alien squad, I don't have to do that anymore. And she initially holds a bit of resentment towards Yuri because Yuri is the dead weight on their team, and she's like, you're kind of ruining this for me. Not the horrible aliens that want to kill me, but you want, you are ruining this for me. Then you got Kasumi, who is this weird prodigy. She's got, like you said, she's kind of perfect at all this stuff. And apparently she's joined the squad to kind of fill a void that's left by her brother going to a faraway school. And so she just doesn't want to feel alone anymore. So she finds this way to kind of vent. And that's why her being imprinted upon by, I think it's what, the yellow...
Yellow Knife. Something.
It is Yellow Knife. Yeah. I kind of wanted to call it a Yellow Jacket, but yeah. Yeah,
exactly. I know that.
That's why she falls victim to it, is because she's kind of open to the idea of not wanting to be alone. And the Yellow Knife kind of understands that slash feeds on that.
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, they end up, you know, bonding in this way. And she's kind of just like, well, I never have to be alone now because I've got this guy inside my head with me. So that's cool. It's a bizarrely kind of happy ending.
Yeah, like that's the thing that's really sort of surprising about this, is it's a series that plays the idea that these girls are basically forced to put these Borgs on, or even the some that choose it. There's no way to do it beyond saying like, hey, this Borg, this little like frog hat thing is going to sit on your head, lick all the sweat off your body at times, like know every feeling you've ever had, and you fight monsters with it. For some reason, you also have to wear roller skates. I guess that's, like, we were like, well, if the helmet, the frog looks like a helmet, you should probably wear roller skates too. It just makes sense.
I assume it was so that they could get around more quickly while chasing after aliens.
I assume it was too, but then sometimes the frog things can sort of, like, fly for a moment or give them wings, so I didn't know anymore. And I was like, look, it just fits an aesthetic. And despite that, there's not, like, a horrible point to this series where everything looks awful and bleak. Like, characters die in this series. And mm-hmm. even that, it's not a moment where everyone else in the cast, like, sits there horrified, staring at the monstrosity and bleakness that everything's become. They're like, no, that person's dead. And then someone might pick them up and be like, I can fix this. And be like, cool. we'll briefly touch on the existential crisis questions of this later. Briefly, though.
I'm not sure you're supposed to be able to grow a person back from just their head and spine, but okay.
Yeah. And you know what? I think in that way, I actually found this series somewhat refreshing for that, because when I saw the initial kind of premise it was shaping itself out to be, I was worried it was going to be another one of those series that was just like, we're going to mutilate young girls. Wow, how macabre of us. And like, I don't know. I just get kind of like bored of that after a while. So I guess I kind of found a small element of refreshingness to the series, that it's like it delves into somewhat similar situations but never has that same reaction. There's a lot of optimism from it. Even at the end of the series, which really felt like it should have gone for another couple volumes to kind of explain some of the ramifications of things. Just the fact that it deals with it in the sense that it's like, hey, yeah, this world's eventually just going to get invaded by countless different forms of these symbiote aliens. But it's cool, because we're all going to have to just, like, try to find a way to live in harmony, and, you know, it's all going to be about those symbiotes, like, selling themselves to humanity to be like, which one do you want? Do you want a slashy cube one? Do you want a funky little fucking sunflower one? What do you want, buddy? So I don't know. There's something kind of unique and nice about that, I guess.
It's also a weird look at like going from the innocence of childhood into the harsh reality of adulthood. Where, you know, like you have to make tough decisions. You have to just kind of live with not getting everything that you want. Like going into the motivations of the characters, like they keep on pushing this point that Yuri is just like a normal kid who really doesn't want to be in this team. And very pretty quickly in the series, about you get, you know, a little bit before the midway point, because it turns out that their club advisor slash mentor slash recruiter, God, what was her name?
The teacher. That's the name. I think it's like Megumi or something like that. It's something relatively common.
Yeah, fairly common Japanese name, but she is essentially keeping tabs on them because one of them has to essentially be like a representative from their group to become like a permanently bonded, with their Borg. So she's making notes at different points in the series. And, after they have their encounter with the Yellow Knife, then it turns out that Kumi is horribly injured. And so most of her body has to be reconstructed from Borg. Then of course the Yellow Knife is bonded with Kasumi. And so she's like, well, that means that they're no longer valid candidates. So Yuri's the last chance that we got, and she's the worst of the three possible candidates that there were going in.
And something we should probably have noted before this is that Yuri's already almost failed, because prior to this, she basically was like to try to get her up to speed, they were like, all right, you take care of all the aliens that we keep in these pens, you know, by yourself. Mm-hmm. And during that process, three boys who wear other aliens. Again, there's not a lot to explain to the context of how this world works. So, like, these kids just get aliens because they think they're cool. And the aliens are like, we're going to go kill this one. And they attack her. And she freaks out because she's so scared. No one's around to help her. Fuses with her symbiote. Basically kills the other alien. Aliens, along with every other alien they had in captivity, before going by, killing her two friends' symbiotes, and then almost killing her friend before, like, finally, like, crying herself out of it. And they're like, wow, that was a really bad situation. That was almost a huge failure that would have gotten me expelled. But we'll just sweep that under the rug, and it becomes the candidate later on. You're like, I don't know about this.
It's one of the first big signs that things aren't as they seem with this organization, though, because at first you're just told, oh yeah, you just wear this thing on your head and it will feed off of your sweat and stuff, and that's it. But it turns out, well, actually no, because you have a psychic connection, and like her friends feel her fear because she's so scared in that moment and nobody comes to help her. And she has that big freak out and they can feel her fear. And from that point onward, after they've done that, they're like, oh, we actually had no idea actually how scared she was. We thought she was just being a bit of a crybaby, but no, she's scared to death. We have to look out for her from now on.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes one of the really nice things about the series is the growing sense of friendship between the three of them. Where you can really believe that more and more Kumi and Kasumi want to look out for Yuri.
Yeah.
There's a point about halfway through, you know, after the Yellow Knife thing and after the stomach eating thing, where Kumi and Kasumi, they're basically just like totally understand each other now because they've been through such similar experiences and, you know, they're no longer fully human and they're having like sleepovers and stuff. And which is to the exclusion of Yuri, who's like, oh, I'm not getting invited to anything. You guys are always... But they confide in each other. You know, this kind of sucks. I'm never going to be able to live a completely normal life again. And I'm never fully alone. And I don't want Yuri to have to go through that. So we have to look out for her. And it's a cool thing because it's a bizarrely mature, but still believable that an 11-year-old would come to that conclusion emotion.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So it's a cool thing.
There's some really interesting parts to this where it you know, it's a sci-fi series that doesn't feel 100% like anything else out there. Probably, I think, more for tone than any other reason. There are parts, though, that are very sort of confusing because of the pacing. We mentioned before, like, this yellow knife character. This thing just shows up at the start of a chapter. Like, aliens have just randomly been attacking, but this thing's the size of the school and is just sitting on top of it and just shows up. And everyone's like, I guess we'll just watch it. And then at the end of everything, or at the end of that chapter, Kasumi just shows up and gets eaten. And she's just like, yay! And you're like, where did any of this come? What's happening here? And that's like a hugely significant event, but it just kind of pops up. And the same thing sort of happens throughout the series where you're just like, oh, I guess Kumi's dead. Like, that's just like a chapter starts with her just being fucking like annihilated and dead. And then another chapter's like, oh shit, Yuri lost her Borg and is nearly dead. And for some reason that makes her an infant because the Borg takes her memories with it. But that aspect stops being a case later on when another alien parasite takes over Yuri instead of the Borg. So, bit of confusion there. But there is just a lot of, like, weird points where you're just like, boom, into the story. You're like, where am I? What's happening? Oh, I'm so scared. All right, let's just go.
There are some cool bits of really clever writing. There's one where – it's actually the one where Kumi seems to be dead to begin with. And it turns out, because basically the idea is that, you know, Kasumi has become one with the yellow knife. Mm. And so there are hints that make it seem like, oh, she's actually secretly evil now. They, like, hack into Kumi's Borg in order to, like, show memory replays and stuff. And so the teacher's, like, seeing all these suspicious things that Kumi has seen Kasumi getting up to. There's actually a really freaky bit where, like, the Borg... Kasumi's Borg doesn't want to sit on her head and bond with her because, like, he doesn't believe that she's really Kasumi anymore. And so she just kind of like, okay, pries its bottom half open and plops it on her head. So she forces it to bond with her. But so all this stuff is like, oh, she's actually like the yellow knife. She's not really Kasumi. Like you even see Kumi like confiding in you. Like, I think that something is wrong with her. And then, you know, you see her, like, getting ready to confront Kasumi about it, and then, and then it gets to where, you know, Kasumi and Yuri are alone on patrol together, and Kasumi, like, extends her tendrils. No, it's actually that she was attacking the thing that was actually attacked and nearly killed Kumi. Mm-hmm. So, like, all through the chapter, you think it's building up to this reveal that Kasumi is evil now, and it's like, no, actually, no. She's just, like, cool and just different, and her Borg doesn't really like her as much anymore. That's it.
Yeah, there's somewhat, I guess, maybe of an undertone to this story of the idea of, like, hey, parasites aren't as bad as that word makes it out to be. Like, a lot of times it just helps you live in complete harmony because you have a symbiotic nature. One has to kind of feed the other. Because, again, that's the conclusion of the story, is just, like, sort of the acceptance of the idea that all these other aliens, they call the I guess the race that we know of from the start of Erdo, like the Drill type or something like that.
The Drill tribe or whatever. The
Drill tribe, yeah, I think. And they're like, they have to accept, like, all these other alien races are coming now, all these other symbiotes, like the Sunflower tribe is one we see a lot of, and you have to assume more yellow knives are going to come as well. And it's like, yeah, they're going to come, and they're probably all going to feed off humanity because we have a ton of electricity to provide. That's something unique to our, you know, race. And no one's really like, it's not like everyone's screaming around at the realization of this. Everyone's kind of just like, yeah, okay, let's go see how that is. And, like, I guess that's sort of a piece you're supposed to pull away from this. It's not like there's a long discussion between any characters to really reach that point. No one has to, like, fight against the idea that it's not going to be okay, then realize it's not. It's just sort of kind of accepted.
Yeah, this is reality, and it's going to happen, so we have to find the best way for us to get along in it. That's kind of it. There are some cool, interesting bits in it. There's this whole, like, Sunflower tribe invasion that happens, and they do things differently than the Drills do, because the Sunflowers don't care if the bond is, like, a willing one or not. And so one of them ends up taking over Yuri and turning them against her friends. There's actually a really creepy climax because they have this, you know, internal battle thing where Kumi and Yuri's Borg try and pull her out so that she doesn't have to die in order to defeat her sunflower Borg thing. And you see, like, she's essentially, like, being cheered on by, like, the sunflowers inside her own head to murder her memories of her friends. And as she's doing it, she's turning more and more into this crawly sunflower thing. And it's like, ugh. It wouldn't be so creepy if you didn't have her innocent 10-year-old head poking out of that.
Yeah, it's a little bit. There's a wee bit of that.
And at the end of it, you know, it's like Kumi is like urging her on. It's like, no, you can't lose at this point. And then they have she like just off panel kisses her. And that's a like right at the moment where Yuri is brought back from the brink and is saved. That's really it.
Actually, there's one quick thing I want to mention because we alluded to it, but we didn't go into detail. There is like, somewhat like, subtext. It's more blatant than subtext, but it's not outright stated. There is the lesbian relationship we hinted at before, and I actually like the way this was kind of handled because it happens essentially with Kumi. That she's the one who fuses with the alien and becomes this, you know, Borg-like person. And she's kind of worried, like, one of the first response she has that she's like in bed, she's like, oh, I will never be able to get married now and things like that. But, she spends a whole lot of time with Kasumi after that. And almost all the time she does, she spends it talking about Yuri and being worried about Yuri. And there's this point where Yuri is dying and there's sort of like this fever dream sort of thing where Kumi first sees herself with like a man behind her, like just like a silhouette kind of a man. And then it like pulls away and it's Kasumi and she's like, don't you think you should be with her? She's the one you care about. And that's when Kumi realizes like her feelings and just goes full force into trying to rescue Yuri and be with her essentially. It's not like blatantly forced upon you, but there's enough kind of subtlety to it and interesting like picking and choosing of when to portray this like storyline that I really liked it. It's sort of an understated part of the story.
And it also, of course, falls into, you know, the sense of cooperation that you have in order to survive in this world. And one of the things that happens in the last volume of the series is at the end of each chapter, you see snippets from this conversation that Kumi is having with their teacher and what it means to be bonded with the Borg and to become one with that person or to become one with that being and how she's happy with the way that she is, despite how unpleasant it might sound to someone who doesn't really understand it. And towards the end of that conversation, Kumi asks her, so is it like being married? And she's like, well, kind of, but no, but you can see where her mentality is at while she's going through that. And it makes sense that as she becomes more Borg than human, that she has more of that desire to become cooperative with someone else and becomes more and more in touch with her feelings for her friend. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think by and large, this is sort of a series that there's not a ton of content to talk about. So there's not really, and maybe there's something we've missed or something like that, but I don't think there's too much more of a series to really dissect. This is one of those series where it's like, it's not a traditional horror series or anything like that. There are some body horror moments, but they're not as grotesque as others. You know, this isn't like, you know, Gyo or, you know, even Ubitsu or anything like that. You're not going to get something that's that gross. And there's actually one scene I thought was kind of dope when one of the sunflowers, like, Kumi tries to stop Yuri and it just systematically cuts off all of her limbs and she's just this, like, limbless kind of, like, torso sitting there. But it's not, like, full of blood and violence everywhere. It was just, like, that's how that creature chooses to, like, neutralize her. And then later on she just gets thrown in a fucking tank and she's got all of her limbs back. It's just, like, it's a pretty convenient world here.
Kasumi gets some badass moments towards the end because she's like fully bonded with her powers with the yellow knife. She can like disable things by emitting psychic waves at them. And this kind of like imbibes itself by her hair becoming antenna. And she's just like, as she's figured out how to do this, she's just like, yeah, I'm badass.
There's a lot of like shots of her rising triumphantly out of like the husk of a monster. Like, ah!
It, like, it'll eat her, and then she'll just be like, shit, that's like, yeah!
So, to, like, just cover it, I think this series is decent. I have a hard time knowing who to recommend it to. I guess I'd recommend it more to maybe sci-fi fans than I would horror fans, though I think you can still enjoy it even if you're into just horror. There is an element to it there that I think you can dig. And again, this is a relatively short series, so I don't think you're losing too much out in like giving the series at least a test run.
It took me only about 2 or 3 hours to read the whole thing. Yeah. So, I would also say that it would probably fit in if you're into kind of sci-fi stuff. You know, it uses aliens in order to explore more kind of traditional themes of, compatibility and, maturity. So that's kind of what sci-fi is supposed to do, is to use a bizarre scenario in order to explore a more familiar concept. So,
yippers.
All right. Well, that said, let us move on to the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap. And this is going to be a little bit easier than normal because Crunchyroll didn't put up a Seven Deadly Sins chapter. And also we don't have any Astra.
It's just our usual sorts of series here.
Yep. So we're going to start things off with My Hero Academia, which was off last week. Mm-hmm. So we're back now with chapter 154, Unforeseen Hope. Last time, of course, Overhaul bonded with one of his minions to become a four-armed weird monster guy. Which, as Deku observes at the beginning of this chapter, is even worse than it sounds.
But Nick, what's Deku's name?
Midoriya.
But don't you mean Midburiya, Nick? Halloween month hashtag.
I mean, you could have called him Dekboo. Like,
that's Nick. I'm saving some stuff for the rest of the month. All right, it's a whole month of Halloween episodes. All right, I gotta save some content for the end.
So, it's even worse as Midburiya, observes because Overhaul also gained his stamina back and is no longer injured from the fight that he's been in so far. So it's basically like he's coming in fresh, and also stronger than before. Yay! That sucks. Also, Overhaul taunts them by saying that, and Lemillion has lost his quirk forever. If you'd never gotten involved with Aerie and me, you wouldn't have had to lose your quirk. You could have gone on infected by your worthless dreams. This freaks out Deku. Overhaul snatches up the completed bullets from the ground and then starts summoning more stalagmites to attack his foes. Deku starts to try and fight back by just breaking off the spikes from the ground and launching them at Overhaul. But it doesn't really do much good because Overhaul just kind of like raises the hand up and disintegrates them as they come towards him and then launches more back up at Deku. And, so Deku is quickly repelled. He has to use the iron soles on his boots in order to protect him while he's being attacked from below. Night Eye, starts to engage Overhaul and tells Deku to get Lemillion and Aerie out of there. He uses his weighted stamp things in order to attack, Overhaul. Let's see here. Night Eye also demands to know where the hell Aizawa is. Because in the chaos of all of this, yeah, he kind of disappeared, didn't he? Along with, Chrono.
Yes.
Overall says, well, as you know, I have an interest in quirk erasing quirks, so he's on a guided tour of our VIP room.
Saucy.
And, Night Eye is, of course, really pissed off that Lemillion's, you know, kind of just been, well, destroyed. He says, like, oh, so the bullets are perfected and it's permanent and you used it on Lemillion. I was hoping to sneak away. Overall says, I was hoping to sneak away and keep that a secret. And Night Eye says, you were that scared of Lemillion. He is trying to use his foresight abilities to predict Overhaul's attacks so that he can stay with him as much as he can. He feels a sense of guilt over Mirio, you know, falling in the line of duty, essentially. And we then cut over to where Deku has gotten Eri and Mirio to a pretty safe distance to this point. Mirio is upset because he's thinking that he's going to let Eri down still. Deku opens up a hole in the wall that where they had initially come in and says, hey, yeah, you can get in out through here. Come on, let's get out of here. And Eri is still really upset. You know, she's crying like she usually does.
She just needs to have a bark put on her head. Yeah, calm down, kiddo. You'll be fine.
Here, put this weird sweat-eating frog on your head and you'll be fine. There is a weird bit of narration that we get over the course of the next two pages as Night Eye is continuing to fight against Overhaul because it quickly goes pretty badly for him. Even though he has, you know, this foresight abilities and he's an experienced, hero, he still doesn't have any physical superpowers and he's fighting against someone who can conjure spikes from the ground. Oh no. It's actually a very gruesome shot what happens to him because, that arm is not going back on.
Yeah, there's a pretty brutal visual to kind of like start closing things out. And there's almost a lot of bleakness because it starts telling that story of like how he's been trying to do everything he can to protect Mirio and how he's been kind of constantly interacting with the world, like in events because he's trying to count on the way things are supposed to be going. And when he looked into Chisaki's future, he just sees like blankness.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really like an unnerving sentiment. He sees that basically as he's like,
there's no way we're going to succeed. Yeah. And there's this moment where essentially what happens is he tries to change the future and he uses his foresight ability on Chisaki and he sees a moment where Chisaki is going to manage to touch him and, you know, destroy him. So he takes a different course of action instead. He knew it would simply delay the inevitable, but it was the best option he had. Time is all it bought him, though. Night Eye, needing to cling to something, looked into Shisaki's future, and you see him, you know, impaled on his spikes. And yeah, essentially he just wants to kind of have some assurance that everything's going to be okay, that they're going to succeed. And you just get this big old black panel. Nothing. Yay!
Ruh-roh.
I bet everything's gonna be okay, Chris.
Everything's gonna turn out okay for Deku and his family.
So now it's Deku's turn to fight with Chisaki. Chisaki summons another wave of spikes to come swarming towards Deku. Deku stomps into the ground to stop them from being able to reach him, I guess? Overhaul says he stomped down to the ground to throw off my aim.
Well, the idea, I guess, being that essentially the spikes he's creating are almost like projectiles from the ground. So by shaking the ground, he throws off the aim of them. That's how I kind of read it before.
I guess. Deku realizes that he is not going to be able to do this for very long and that he is injured already, but he's got to try his best. He unleashes one for all to 20% power with the full cloak mode. Overhaul continues to mock him, saying that things have only gotten worse since your reinforcements showed up. Give up before you all die and only manage to prove me right. And Deku says, I'm not going to let that happen. Even if it's already set in stone, I'll smash right past that future. Because, of course, he's familiar with the Night Eye's whole, you know, foresight thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this seems like it's going to be kind of a big moment here because this really feels like the thing that this whole hero, what would you call it? Mentoring arc has been leading up to is Deku getting this chance to prove Night Eye's foresight wrong. So if he's got the ability to do that, then things would change for, yeah.
I like this. It's first and foremost, I always appreciate the fact that the way, Horikoshi has done Deku's powers has always left so much more room to grow. Like, this is Deku at 20%, and this is already, like, holy shit. Like, it still just leaves so much more room to go in that makes things kind of exciting to think about the future. But I also just like that we got this moment with Night Eye, him kind of putting this big sacrifice into place. I think, you know, there's been somewhat of an issue with Night Eye and his attitude and some of his appearances that have made him somewhat... Not that he's a bad person, but it's just hard to like him in the same way a lot of the other, like, mentor characters in My Hero are just so innately likable, like All Might and Fat Gum and things like that. But showing how he was essentially willing to just die here to protect Mirio, who, even after hearing, like, his powers might be gone, he just has that much respect for Mirio, just kind of makes, I think, Night Eye a great deal more admirable here.
There's also a little, quick little moment where, you know, Night Eye is kind of just thinking to himself that his method of combat has always just been to, you know, observe the opponent and react accordingly based on that to go along with his superpower. And we get this explained via a flashback where he's explaining, here's what you need to do. You know, you must observe the opponent and react accordingly. And so Mirio says, read ahead, but I can't predict the future. And Night Eye apparently completely fucking deadpan serious says, good answer. Very funny.
Quite amusing. But yeah, I think that's, I think it's a good chapter.
All right. And we are going to go then straight to Food Wars. Shokugeki no Suma. It's, chapter 223. Where's the fucking chapter title? Proof of Growth. There it is. Okay. We actually started
Nick,
off.
Don't you mean proof of ghost?
Proof ghost. That's actually better than it could have been.
Hot cha 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 cha! I got validation!
anyway, we actually start off this chapter in the hotel that all the competitors are being put up in. Kinokuni is talking with Kuga while Kuga's hanging out in apparently a massage chair.
Yeah, they're so exhausted from all the cooking they did, Nick. Remember.
He's in, like, max chill-out mode in his bathrobe, and he's like,
He's like, what's happening?
And then he's also going to go in the hot tub later, too. So he's just like, ah, everything will be fine.
Yeah.
Kinokuni is like, so aren't you gonna go to the arena later? And Kuga's like, nope, I've already done everything I can do. And then, as he gets up for a visual gag, all of a sudden he turns into, like, this 50-year-old woman in the complete with, like, pearls and makeup and a different hairdo. Like,
yeah.
Because he's a matchmaker all of a sudden.
Well, it's just like, it's almost that thing of like, did he actually change his clothes for this visual gag?
Or is
he
just visualizing?
He just threw his robe back on then, wiped the lipstick off, got rid of those fake lashes.
And I'm not even sure what, this must be some sort of like a cultural thing because he doesn't say anything like related to matchmaking, because he just says, I think we'll let the young ones figure it out for themselves and go, ho, 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 ho.
I think the joke I can get more from it is the idea of him referring to them as young ones when it's like, most of the people there are older than you. Like, you're a second year. There's like 4 third year students there.
Let's see here. There's a little bit of a disagreement over, hey, you lost. Yeah, well, you lost too, and you had me, Misaki, helping you, asshole. essentially, you know, they're like, oh yeah, it sucks. We got to kind of like rely on the first tiers. But Kinokuni then points out, hey, you know, when I was having my match with Soma Yukihira, I don't know, I got this feeling like, are you sure that he's a mere first year student? And he was like, the fuck she talking about?
See,
but building on the idea that was established in the previous chapter with the start of the conversation with Senzaemon and Izami that, oh yes, it's a collection of jewels that he went out of his way to collect. So
I like the scene for two reasons. The first is just the obvious, like it builds upon that like mystique we heard about last time, where it's just like you've been building this class, like what is this idea that maybe Soma's not just as normal of a student as we keep thinking. But more so, I just like the idea that like Kinokuni and Kuga and potentially the other members of the Council of Ten who have lost can still be characters who are going to sit around and interact. Like, it's not like, again, you have to remember this is a cooking series in a school. Like, it's not like these are the members of Akatsuki and like the only way after defeat that they can exist is in the grave or something like that. It's like, no, there's still going to be classmates around. Like, it would make sense that they're still around hanging out and talking to each other. And it's nice to do something with these characters who we didn't get a whole lot of throughout the rest of the series. They had their big fight and then like just go off into this. And it's like, no, keep Kinokuni around, have her do things. Keep, you know, yeah, those and, characters around.
If this reveal that we got started in the last chapter goes the direction we were talking about, where potentially things could go beyond even this school year after this competition is over with, Kuga and Kinokuni are only second year students, so they would be around in that next school year too. Mm-hmm. So it'd be nice to have them continue to remain established like that.
Yes.
So we get some bits of Takumi and Megumi and Soma all working
but
together.
But Nick, don't you mean Tekbumi and Megbumi?
And so boom!
Nick, that doesn't make sense at all.
You leave this to the experts.
Yeah. Nick, that's why I'm Mr. Halloween. That's why your picture isn't Oogie Boogie right now, but mine is.
Well, Mr. Oogie Boogie says. Anyway. They're passing ingredients around, helping each other out, by preparing components for each other's dishes. There's a, you know, a real sense of like activity in their kitchen as stuff is getting passed around, and the judges are observing this with a sense of kind of being impressed by it. Then we get some more focus on Takumi specifically, with like some of the beef that he's been slicing. There's stuff with like ginger. Anyway. The important thing that happens, just skip all over all this commentary because it's not the important part. The important part is during the stagiaire week. Hey, remember when he had that whole, I'm going to cut my hair and be super serious about this? So we see him with short hair for a little bit. but he had to prepare, you know, the restaurant signature dish, which was beef shigurine. What? Shigurine? Shigurine Weaver? I don't know. So he tastes it and is like, oh, I blew my clothes off. It's delicious. I must find the way to make it mine. I must find a way to discover the secret of making something this delicious. And rather than being offended that this guy who was, you know, sent there to help him was trying to, you know, steal the secrets to his restaurant, the restaurant owner was just kind of like, hey, you know, if there's one thing about that signature dish of ours that would be worth stealing, it would be the fact that we have our special needle cut ginger. Basically, the finer the cut you can make with the ginger, the more that you can get out of it. And so he's like, hey, if there was one thing that was worth stealing from our restaurant, I don't know how you would be able to get anything else out of it from that. Or he says it kind of in a more playful way. He just kind of like, you know, the great thing about our restaurant is this awesome ginger. And if there's anything worth stealing from our restaurant, you know, if anyone here were trying to steal something from our restaurant, which they wouldn't, you know, so. But, we get a cool little scene where, cause at the end of the flashback, Takumi is trying to do it. And it's obviously he's not cutting it incredibly fine. And then he does this super awesome needle thin cut in the present, it's a little chance to look cool. Because that was something that we were kind of seeing stuff out of, like, Ishiki, for example, earlier in the competition. So let's see here. Everyone is super impressed by what he's doing. He is going to make the shigaroni beef into a pizza topping. It's like, oh, that's the most Italian of everything. That's amazing.
They're like, ah, the pizza. That sounds so delicious. We put a meatball on there. We put a little grattoni. Yeah.
But then we cut over to Aizan, who is observing what Takumi's up to. And he's like, ah, oh, shigaroni, eh?
I don't know what sound effect is appropriate for that face. It's like, man, that's a horrifying expression to have. Like, you're like, dude, you figured out maybe a way to counter this dude's dish, but that is the look that I feel like something like Todd McFarlane should be drawing for that clown that reaps children or something like that. You know, like, it's so extremely gross.
Well, we do actually do know the sound that it makes. The sound is smook. And, like, one random observer is just gonna, like, what are you doing? Where are you going? Ah, I need to get a new ingredient. I have to go to the storehouse and get it. And he's like, I'm so evil.
Who else to battle Mario than his eternal nemesis, Wario?
That was the Mandark laugh. What were you doing?
He gets in there both. He's both of them. He's Wandark.
Manduario. But yeah, he's like, oh, it's a real shame that all this pride and self-confidence will just get crushed all over again. I don't know if it was ever actually established exactly if Aizan actually had any sort of resentment towards Takumi, or if he was literally only using him as a pawn so that he could get Mimasaka to go after Soma and possibly get him kicked out. I think that that was the story thus far, but he seems to really not like Takumi in this instance.
I think he doesn't really like anybody, to be fair. He's a douche. He's just kind of an asshole.
I don't think that we've seen him get along with literally anyone to this point, so, yeah.
Money. I've seen him like money a lot.
But yeah. Okay. We just...
Yeah, we'll see what happens from this.
Next chapter, really. All right, so we'll move on now to Dr. Stone.
Don't Chris. You mean, Nick, it's time to get Dr. Tombstone.
I really should have seen that coming, shouldn't I? Oh, well. Z equals 29, Senku's lab. I'm finding it increasingly difficult to ignore the fact that whenever they have these, like, characters dressing up in more modern clothing to, you know, kind of, like, imagine the world of science that awaits them and stuff, it always seems to be just an excuse to focus on Kohaku's ass in a different set of clothing.
Those pants seem really big, though, so I don't think it's supposed to be fully just her ass. I think we're supposed to appreciate, like, the anti-gravity of it.
I don't know. That seam is suspiciously placed, is all I'm saying. Anyhow.
In reference to...
Nothing. I don't know. You go draw your own conclusion. Anyhow.
All right.
So, Senku and company have gotten glass. They were able to get proper glasses installed in Suika's mask so that she can wear her watermelon hat thing, but also, you know, see. But now they're going to move on to try and basically get the tools necessary to actually get a laboratory going so that they can make the cure for Ruri. So they basically start melting down a bunch of glass so that they can use it for blowing. They craft a glass crafting kiln. Then Chrome takes an iron tube And it's like, all right, and then we use this, we blow through it and inflate the glass. And the next panel is just all these weird modern art slash pieces of shit looking things. I love the faces that everyone is making in the reaction panel, but especially Senku and Chrome, who look like they're out of a different work of art entirely.
Yeah, these like crazy weird contorted lips and everything like that.
But Senku's like, oh, you know, it's okay. You know, that's just how it's going to be. You know, when I was just getting used to making earthenware stuff, it took me months to get used to it. Chrome's like, but we don't have months to get used to doing this. We have to, you know, cure really quickly. But Senku's like, well, you know, none of us are glass artisans, so we're just going to have to try and figure this out through trial and error. But Chrome's like, artisans? And, quick little time skip. He has gone to the village and then come back with an old man tied up in rope.
Oh, Nick, do you think he's gonna get peanuts?
He'll get his peanuts, all right.
that sounded like a threat. I'm scared now.
He gets his version of peanuts in the same chapter. Come on.
Oh, okay. It's Halloween month, so everything's super spooky to me now, Nick.
Shadows lurking around every corner. Every single one of the shapes could be an old man who's not getting peanuts.
It could be some old man deprived of his peanuts.
You're just haunted by the memory of Jakku. No! No! I don't think he got his peanuts!
I don't know if he ever went back to get them! No!
Chris, I didn't get my peanuts. You were right to be afraid for me.
There's no light!
Anyway, it's Kaseki from the village. Chrome immediately begs him for help using his crafting skills. I love Kaseki's weird way of, like, turning him down, which is like, oh, getting kinky with rope is how you act for a favor.
Like, he's just like, trying to turn me on, it's not going to do it, all right?
Oh, man. I do immediately take a liking to Kaseki because he's just got a very blunt way of dealing with people. He's like, oh, you think that you're going to get me to help you out with your S&M finish, huh? Well, it won't work.
I can resist. I won't be swayed in by your tempting gaze.
Oh, man. I love there's just a quick little bit after he does this where Suika, while he's still tied up, is just like, oh, here's the lacquer that Suika borrows. Oh, yes, thank you. Senku recalls, oh, hey, yeah, the shield that Kohaku's got. Yeah, you made that, didn't you? And you did this without, like, iron tools or dyes or anything. That's really impressive. And so he's like, huh. But I was hoping that I could, you know, find a skilled artisan, but I didn't expect him to be like you. And all this stuff around here, that suspension bridge, yeah, it's like all that, yeah, yeah. But then he looks down at the glass, and he's just like, what the hell is this? And immediately Chrome and Sekiro is like, oh, we got him! Senku says, check this out. This is gonna get you really excited, I'm sure. And he's like, oh, more roleplay! Well, let's have at it. It's not my thing,
He's like, fine, bring on the nipple clamps. Let's see where this is going.
You perverted kids these days, God grief. I mean, God, you're into some weird shit. No
appreciation for the good old days of just using hot wax on the back.
So they get a big old glob of glass on their iron tube. And immediately Kaseki is interested. It's like, what the hell is this stuff? It's soft when it's heated. It changes shape like animal fat. Oh, it's so simple to work with. Look at him blow it. But immediately Chrome fucks it up. He's like, oh, I inflated it too much again. And then Senku, as he's trying to whirl it around to turn into a shape, he's spinning it unevenly. He's doing it wrong. I can tell that he's doing it wrong. But Senku's just, like, grins and mocks in mockery at him, and he says, like, ah, yeah, you must be drooling at the sight of all this glass working. Bet you're getting real antsy just sitting there, Kaseki, you old fossil. Gaseki's like, oh, you found my finish! That's my real turn-on! Keep on dirty talking me, you bastard!
Call me daddy now! No.
Says the safe word immediately. So Gaseki bursts out of the rope that they've got him tied him up in, and he's like, oh, let me give this a try. And he's fucking rippling with muscle. He's just this ridiculously ripped old man. And immediately he just grabs the tube, blows up a nice, perfectly round bubble with the glass, pinches in some tongs, cools it with water, and draws it into this perfect bulbous beaker. And, yeah, they do that right away. And, yeah, they've got a chemistry lab set going in just a short while. And, there's a quick little moment where Senku just has a flashback to when he was a kid staring at that, you know, scientific lab that his dad purchased for him. And he just gets this, you know, really nostalgic look on his face. Aww. He does have a soul.
You do have to like that we have just been incrementally building up to essentially getting, like, Senku a laboratory, like a science lab at this point. It's like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Senku kind of snapped out of it, and then we get this just brief look at the Kingdom of Science, just this little layout of their little village that they've got going, because they kind of forget, like, oh yeah, they've actually done a lot and built a lot of structures in the last several chapters, haven't they? Then we cut over to Kinro and Ginro, and immediately Ginro is just like, look at all those sparkly things over there, and we're just slaving away practicing. Hey, Ginro, I have an idea. What if the tip of your spear was all shiny, and then you would even be able to judge distance better, even with your fuzzy eye disease? And Kinder's like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know, if we had shiny things like gold and silver spears, you know, I mean, it's not like a special thing that we need. It's something that's essential, you know, in order to help you get better at practice, right?
And I like that. That's enough for him to be like,
yeah, okay.
Let's do it.
Also, Ginro's tongue turns into a snake because he's trying to be, I guess, convincing. But, yeah, so Senku's like, hey, Kaku, are they actually, like, do they actually need this? And Kaku's like, no, they just want gold and silver spears. They're total dorks. So Senku gets an idea because, like, hey, we've got this glassware and, you know, this is something we need to, but, you know, there's something else that we need, a certain ingredient, but I'll make you stuff, but I'm only going to make a silver one. And Ginro's like, oh, well, I guess it must be my charm. But Senku's like, no, seriously, like, I'm actually sending you guys on a mission where you might die going on it, because you have to go to a ridiculously dangerous place where one wrong move means instant death. I'm gonna need you to put your life on the line for this.
So, well, goodbye.
Just right on from one thing to another. But nice, fun little chapter, and I, if there's one thing that this series seems to be good at, it's just very, very quickly establishing a new character and giving you a feel for who they are and what's cool about them. So.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy how we get these characters, and even sometimes we get them for just a moment, and then they're kind of like gone. But I love that idea of like showing up, popping in there, having like a character kind of entertain us for a little bit, and then later on we might get more of them. Like, mm-hmm. We're just slowly building this cast up kind of more and more as time goes on, to the point where like we're gonna eventually have like a true village at some point, it feels like, once like everything with Senku and, oh man, I'm forgetting what the other Taiju? No. What's his friend? The muscle
it
guy.
Is Taiju.
Is it Taiju? When, like, Taiju and Senku finally actually get to meet up again, there's, like, gonna be, like, a whole town, presumably, to, like, have characters and hang out with them and things like that. So I'm pretty stoked for that. I liked our old guy here. I like that we're gonna get more out of Kinro and Ginro, it seems like. Just all good.
Hmm. All right.
All right. So let's move on then to We Never Learn, question 33, Geniuses and a Predecessor Cause Mental Anguish for X. Now, of course, guys, let's just quickly remind you of our cast here. We've got Rizbu Ogata, Boomy Boo, Takamote Bone, and of course, Asbumi Koman Boom Nami. All right, so, and there's also a dude. So, who I couldn't put Boo into. So,
you could put Boo into Yuiga? Booiga!
That doesn't make sense. Yeah, come on. Maybe next week you'll get it. All right. So, last time we kind of got this impression that, Asumi was going to be joining into the four person, you know, study group to make it a five person group. And we get further follow up to that not only is that happening, but the other three girls are also joining summer school. They're joining that cram school that, the other two are going to. And there's a bit at the start where, you know, Asumi is talking with Uega and is kind of asking what his relationship to the other three girls is. And of course, he kind of gives him, like, you know, the traditional answers, like, yeah, I helped them study. You know, it's this whole thing, you know, they're, you know, kind of dim at some points, but they're all getting more confident and soon they won't need me at all. And as if to follow that up, it's then the first day of class and the first break that happens, every one of the girls comes running to Uega like, oh, everything's bad. Help me. Help me. Help me. This is awful. I even specifically like when Fumito shows up, she's like, slap me hard, the nefarious mathematical formulas assail me mercilessly, entice me towards the subnefarious abyss. He's just like, what? It's like how all of them like react to it. Like, Takamoto's just like, I think we should just take pride in being Japanese and be our own content, not even worry about speaking another language because she has to study English. And Asumi responds to all this by being like, shut the fuck up. If all of you fuck up my studies, I'll kill you. but they, you know, presumably all kind of reach this point of like understanding one another. Cause, you know, as they're having their issues, Asumi kind of explains like how they should be approaching it, how it's like, you know, cram school doesn't exist for, you know, like their books aren't good for self-study, but they're intended for a classroom use. So when you study on your own, you know, use textbooks from other stores, things like that. And that's how you can kind of get the best out of cram school. And, you know, all the girls kind of appreciate her a bit more because of it. That is a very quick joke, where all the girls are walking home and it spontaneously rains. So they all go to, Asumi's place. And of course,
but hold on. First we get everyone fucking up what the name of the storm is because, it's a squall. See? Mm-hmm. And so we first get Uruka saying, it's a sudden sprawl. I mean, squaw. I mean, whatchamacallit. And oh God, just like, it's a sudden scrawl, Takemoto. It's like, aren't you the science person? Shouldn't you know that term?
She's like, I can tell you what a squall does, but words are beyond me. It's like, that feels like a big problem.
I just love because, you know, you just get like their chippy faces next to their word bubbles, so you know who's talking. And I love that you can tell that Ogata's saying it with total confidence. She's completely wrong.
Yeah. So all the girls and Uega go back to Asumi's place. Of course, there's a brief joke of him looking over and seeing Takamoto's bra through her shirt because it's raining, of course. And he notes that it's the bra that she bought when she was, you know, in the store and he was stuck in that mascot costume. And he's like, oh, but she said she was buying that bra for her crush. Oh, what's happening? And of course, she's like, oh, I wonder if Naruyuki likes it because it's in his style. You know, the shopkeeper recommended it. And I kind of like that they're having this whole reaction. And Asumi's just like, what's going on with them? And Ogata's just like, who knows? Maybe that's like a dance of some kind. Like,
well, because they're like both holding their hands over their faces. Like, going, So it's like, no, I can totally see that.
Yeah, it's like, what are they doing? I don't know. you know, and then Fumito goes to thank Asumi's father for, you know, giving them towels and letting them stay there and everything like that. And from that conversation, she hears how, it's the first time, my daughter's ever brought a boyfriend home, so I'm quite relieved. And I like if Fumito has this, really, like, face where she just gets, like, the V face and her eyes are closed, and it's, like, three panels later of her, like, walking up the door, knocking on it, walking up, saying, like, Furuhashi, like, come out here. Yueka leaving, and then she just fucking karate chops him, like, in the stomach with the same expression. and it's immediately followed up. Again, they've thankfully avoided the thing of making this, like, a long-term issue. Every time one of these misunderstandings happens, Yueka seems to explain it away immediately, just by being like, no, we're not actually boyfriend and girlfriend. Like, it's just a lie we made up. And Sumi's like, yeah, I asked him to. It's for my own reasons. I need a story to tell Dad, so it's not his fault. And for me, it's just like, oh, okay, that's all. So you don't have any feelings. She's like, well, I didn't say that. I like him pretty well. He's cute, isn't he? Just kidding. And, you know, after seeing their reactions, and she has this moment. It's almost, I don't know why. Like, it's
context would be a very creepy, threatening panel.
Yeah. Because she's like, oh, don't take everything so seriously. And you, Furuhashi, how come you're so interested? Is it because you have feelings for him? And then that reaction is like, nope, not one iota. Like, with the entire, like, screen falling around behind it. I'm not sure if that's meant to be the true honesty of it or not. I'm really in that state where I don't know if Fumito is supposed to have feelings for him.
Well, she's so in denial over it at this point that we're not really going to know for sure for a while, I don't think.
Yeah. But that's essentially the end that happens there. We then cut away then to the maid cafe, and Yueka's just thinking about how he's like, huh, yeah, that joke was really wasn't funny. It nearly gave me a heart attack, but I didn't notice it before because she looks so young, but she's actually super gorgeous. And as, like, I guess Asumi's just kind of like a shit stirrer, because she's just like, so which one do you really like? He's like, why are we back to this? There's exams. I have no time for this, obviously. She's like, but what if you didn't have exams? He's like, shit, I never thought of that before. So
you would just be like,
he's like, oh my god.
After exams? Oh my god, like after the world ends, what am I gonna do?
It's like, I could has girls then? So she
dropped. Wait, what's this thing between my legs? I've never noticed it before!
What the fuck is happening? So Fumito dropped, or not Fumito, Asumi drops the fucking, I think it's just an omelet, isn't it, generally? Like the omelet thing down that you could write on with ketchup?
Yeah.
So she drops that down. And mentions like, look, this is, normally a special service, and I don't do this for free of charge. But what if I said I wasn't really joking? You know? Yueka's like, huh? What? She's like, aren't you kind of curious how I really feel? And then she points down to the omelet, and it just says you player on it with like a heart. And he's like, fuck you. Basically, I assume it's supposed to be like a joke. Like she's just still teasing him about it right now.
I did love the comment because he's like, still gonna eat it.
Yeah. I like her comment too. She's like, all right, that's kind of weird. He's like, what's what you're supposed to do? He's like, I didn't get enough bread crust this week. This is a great filler.
I don't think that there's too many especially standout moments from this chapter, but I really like it overall in terms of establishing, her Asumi's dynamic with the group, not just in terms of being the shitster, but in terms of the fact that she's a little bit older than them and has a better grasp on, you know, boys and dating and stuff, to the point where she is more comfortable with addressing these things. And you get the feeling that if she did actually have a crush on Yueka, then, and it's possible, but I don't think that it is the case, that she could actually, you know, go after him. And I think that that kind of presence is invaluable because there's only so many different girls you can have be part of this group who have crushes on Yueka, but can't do anything about it because they're nervous about what's going to happen. And it's really nice to just have someone interject into this that is confident in themselves, but not excessively to the point where they get in their own way like Marika did in Nisekoi.
Mm-hmm. I like her as well, too, because the first time I read this, I actually didn't get it. It was a joke at the end. I thought she was really just outwardly confessing. I was like, oh, that's a bit strange. But then once I realized, I was like, oh, she's just fucking with him. That's great. Like, she just spends half this chapter just fucking teasing the shit out of him and Fumino and everything like that. I enjoy it. I do get the idea, though, that over time, she probably will, like, I think at this point it seems likely she will actually develop feelings for him and play into that. But I definitely like, at least for right now, having a character in there who just, I don't know. I feel like every harem character just, or every harem story needs a character who just pokes fun at the absurdity of that concept for a while. And I just like her shitting on, like, just being like, fucking ridiculing Yuega for being a player who doesn't realize he has like three chicks pining after him, and he doesn't really like not realizing, like, yeah, you know, like school, like exams end at a point, right? And you could do whatever. Like, what? I like her. She's a mean, but she's a fun kind of mean.
I also think that there's a possibility here, and this could be interesting, that maybe this will be a case where Yuega actually gets a crush on somebody else. It seems like towards the end, there might have been hints towards something like that, with him having that big revelation that she pushed on him, like, hey, you know, it's possible he could actually pursue romance at some point. And also him recognizing, hey, she's actually really pretty, now that I actually, you know, take some time to look at her. And, you know, that admiration that he had for her ability to study and stuff like that, the fact that they're going to have to continue to pretend to date and stuff. It might be an interesting twist on things to have him be the one who is an admirer of somebody else, as opposed to being just constantly ignorant of other people's feelings, and that's it.
I just want to say, I don't know if I related to any moment this week, though, harder than him being like, yeah, right, I'm still going to eat this, though. Like, I was like, I'd be right there with you, where I'm like, that's mean, but I'm going to eat this insult, literally, because I am famished and you offered me free food.
All right. Okay, let's move on to The Promised Neverland. Chapter 57, A Deal, Part 2. So, last time Emma and Ray told everyone that they were planning on taking the nameless older guy with them as their guide slash protector, as they went towards the new location that Minerva had outlined for them. And then he approached them with a knife, and they were like, hey, let's make a deal. And he's like, what the fuck? I like the very beginning, like, Emma is still like, hi, so I'm Emma. What's your name? Get out!
Get out of my house! All right, let's try again.
It's the infinite, like, she's a kindergarten teacher, basically. Okay, so, why don't you take a seat? I'm gonna sit, fine, okay, yeah, all right. Gilda, bring over some soup. Hey, sorry for taking your cookies. You must be hungry. Here, have some soup. It's not poison. See, I'm trying it.
Good soup. Yeah, like, he's like, oh, nope. Maybe I'll try a bite. She's like, get the fuck off my soup. It's too good. I want it now.
You know, we're not going to be like a burden on you. We can grow our own food. We've got our own supplies. We're not going to run you out of the house and home. Come on, we'll be fine. We know you don't actually care about the supplies being limited and stuff, so, you know. And Ray is thinking to himself as she's addressing him about this, because he's like, yeah, we figured it out after we were looking around the shelter, because, you know, he's talked about us being useless and supplies being limited, but they're all actually excuses, because, the shelter is set up to allow all of us to survive. And, he's got some sort of a different reason. We know that he does. He is, as Ray puts it, full of unnecessary dialogue and actions.
Everything
must be essential.
Everything he does is unnecessary. Not like me. Everything I does has a purpose. Like, I don't punch somebody. I do the threefold punch like learned from Rurouni Kenshin. Even the weird finger slappy thing at the end. Because I don't waste a single iota of energy. Also say iota, because that's a cool word.
He just switched to talking out loud at some point. Ray! Important conversation! Trying to get us a guide!
Every thought I have is important. That's why I started saying them out loud, Emma. God, Emma's such a bitch. I wish I had her hair, though. Her hair's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Boing.
I wasn't talking to you. I was talking out loud to hashtag Ray. I refer to myself in the third person now, so sometimes.
Emma is like, anyway, we're going to go see Mr. Minerva. We want you to be our bodyguard and our guide. Look, we know you're strong because you've survived 13 years on your own, and you have probably gone outside a whole lot. And a bunch of little kids are like, what are you talking about? And Ray's like, oh, his shells are worn out, and his stomach isn't flabby at all. In fact, he's got abs. And there were tree nuts hanging in the pantry. Those aren't available in the garden and can't be grown. I never pray no. He probably went to the forest under water to get them. So basically what they establish is like, this isn't a guy who's just been hiding in this shack this whole time, waiting and waiting. He has actually been venturing out to very dangerous areas, including by the water, which they're specifically warned away from because that's where poachers could be. Also with his actions to this point, he managed to free himself of the restraints with the knife. He shot Emma and missed her very, very closely as a warning shot. Which took an incredible amount of accuracy. So they know that he is incredibly capable, is the long and short of it. So Emma confronts him and says, like, hey, this letter, you know, we found it and it was, you know, already open. So we know that you know about Minerva's message to try and rendezvous with him. And we're going to go out and try and do this. And we want your help. We want your experience and we want your skills. And the guy's just like, nope, go away, leave.
Fuck off.
So, and Emma says, well, we are going to leave after we found Mr. Minerva and come back safely. Then we'll leave this shelter. All of us will leave this shelter. And the guy's like, that's it? Those are your conditions for making a deal? No. I could just kill you here and now anyway. And he's got a knife, and he shows off the knife. And it was like, oh, really? You're gonna kill us? Yeah, I'll do it. Sure. And Ray's like, meh. He pulls out the gun. And he says, actually, no, I'm not going to kill you with this. You can have this back. I'm a pacifist. I remove the bullets. Also, I've got this. And he pulls out this little device. And Emma says, see, we found this in the back of the reference room. It's the emergency detonator. Yeah. We fixed it because we saw that the wires were cut, but we fixed it. And Emma says very brightly and happily, it's like, let's make a deal, sir, or else we'll blow up this shelter.
That's that thing. Remember, this is something that The Promised Neverland's done at times where Emma and these characters are very cheery and optimistic when they will say horrifying things. I forget where the scene before this was, but there was definitely another scene almost exactly to this point where Emma was like very bluntly kind of I think it was the idea of them like talking about how they would just like die in the house if they couldn't escape. Like, just that idea of, like, you're just not going to be able to use this as food! We'll never give up! Fuck yourself! Like, it's like, this weird, like, bleakness that's just kind of cool at that same way, but still terrifying.
And, Emma says, hey, if we're gonna get killed, then I'd rather just, you know, blow this place up and get it over with quickly. You know, that's nice. And so the guy immediately is like, they're crazy. This isn't a deal. I'm just being threatened into this. This sucks. Okay. Well, fine. This might be fun. He's like, okay, fine. If you want to die so much, then I'll let you. And, so I'll help you find Minerva. But I'm only going to guide you. I won't protect you and I won't risk my life. And I was like, okay. All right. What's your name? I'm not going to tell you, Antenna Shorty. And I like how Emma's just like, is he talking about me? What? Antenna? What's he talking about?
It's like, you should know you style your own hair, presumably.
No, it grows naturally like this.
That seems impossible.
I kind of like that the guy is still refusing to say what his name is. Even though it just makes things more difficult considering that they now are going to be working together. And Emma just kind of dubs him Nameless Man for the time being, so.
But Nick, don't you mean Nameless Man, boo?
No, I don't.
But Nick, don't you mean Nameless Boo Man?
I mean, that's not worse than the one that you just said, but...
Then it's an improvement! Always achieve your next level!
I wouldn't say that, and also you missed a prime opportunity to say improvement.
Nick, I'm not a fucking WWE gimmick, okay? Like, I could do something else.
I can't just have one catchphrase I fit into everything.
It's like I just put boo into everything, all right? I'm more complex.
You gotta read between the lines and discover that.
There are layers to me, Nick. Like an ogre. Or a bunion.
All right, so that's Promised Neverland this week. Mostly just confirming stuff that we had concluded on last time. I do like the utter confidence that Ray and Emma had in kind of just browbeating this guy into helping them. And that full page spread where Emma's just like, help us, we're going to blow up this facility, even with that big bright smile on her face, was quite nice. And it feels like we're getting more going in more of the right direction again with this series.
Yep. I like this chapter a lot.
Cool.
All right, so again, there's no Seven Deadly Sins for this week, anybody who's curious if we're bringing it up. At least the Crunchyroll site didn't release a chapter, so we will have to bring all that stuff up next week. You know, find out what happens to Diane, to Kang, to Boother, and all those people.
Fuck you. All right, let's move on to Black Clover. Before we get into the chapter itself... I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Black Clover's anime just debuted yesterday. You can check it out on Crunchyroll if you have a premium account. If you don't have a premium account, it's going to be available for free next week. I watched the first episode. I skipped around it a little bit. The main comment I'm going to share is Jesus Christ. Asta is so much more annoying when you can hear him.
Oh, please tell me they gave him, like, the Steve Urkel voice. Like, he's just like, oh. Come on, guys, can I have magic?
No, it's not that. He actually has... One of the things that I'm a little bit surprised that they did is that he actually has a male seiyuu. Because in a lot of, you know, shonen series where, you know, someone is, you know, as short, the main character is as short as Asta is... They'll, you know, give him a female, voice actor. Mm-hmm. Like, they did that with Naruto and with Goku and stuff. By the way, it's also Studio Pierrot, the, same studio that did the Naruto anime is doing the Black Clover anime. So that's, gives you an idea of what it'll probably look like. But the problem is that, see, Asta yells, and he yells in a very particular way where he'll draw out the last syllable of what he's shouting. And that gets really annoying! If you hear it over and over again! He just does it all the time. And it's really annoying. So I hope that doesn't happen as much in the future. Because... I'm not going to watch it if he keeps that up.
We'll see. I'm excited to see what the reaction to it is, because this is something that's been a manga for a while, now being kind of sent out to the general public of anime fans. I'm kind of curious to see what the general reaction to it is. A bit worried, because I know the public, like, the general perception I see among manga fans in terms of Black Clover seems to have already filtered out and influenced, like, the anime audience. But I'll be curious to see what that reaction is. Because, again, Black Clover does surprisingly well in the rankings, so I'll be curious to see how it kind of handles with a larger mainstream audience.
Gilly Olsen puts it in a good way. It's like the way that the King said, Team Competition!
Team Competition!
But imagine he does something like that, like, twice every sentence that he speaks. Because, you know, Asta, he's constantly yelling about stuff. So he's constantly drawing out the freaking syllables.
I'm trying to find, like, a line Asta even has this chapter to try to do it, and I can't find one. He doesn't talk until the end.
He doesn't yell a whole lot, because he's being very serious in this chapter. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I have mostly good things to say about it, but that just sticks out like a sore thumb, is that Asta's voice is so annoying. Honestly, a lot of the other stuff that we see in it, most of the animation is quite good. The initial villain that shows up, the guy with the chains that attacks Yuno, that Asta unlocks his powers against, his chains are really badly 3D animated, but I totally understand not wanting to individually draw the movements of the chains, so it's like, whatever. Yuno's voice actor has done a lot of very, you know, deadpan, serious guy roles, so he's quite fine.
I'm surprised they didn't just make a robot to do him.
Asta is my rival.
Beep. We will be Wizard King. Error, error. I will be Wizard King.
I, you know, the human.
Human.
And of course, it's still, they only, the first episode only got so far as to Asta first getting his powers, unveiled. So there's still a lot that they have to show and a lot of cast to introduce. So I'm cautiously optimistic, and I really just hope that Asta doesn't yell like that all the time. So that's basically all I have to say about it. So, all right. Page 127, Golden Black Sparks, with a little bit of a promotion for the Black Clover anime at the beginning here. Last time, Finro was doing pretty well against Langris.
But, Nick, don't you mean Fangris? Boo?
I mean, you were doing pretty good until that last syllable you threw in.
No, that was a hiccup. I said Fangris. Boo. That's what I do. That's how I hiccup. I'd appreciate, I'm kind of sensitive about it. I'd appreciate if you didn't, like, insult it, you know.
So there's, a freaked out moment because, Langris has unleashed his grimoire's magic, summoned a bunch of tiny orbs of, spatial magic to use against Finral. And, Finro was quite freaked out because he recognizes, oh gosh, damn it. What was that girl's name? The one, Mars is definitely not love interest.
Girl. Oh, I can't even remember.
Begins with an F.
Falafel.
Is it Fanzel?
Ferret? Fauna. Fauna doesn't sound right. Pituitous?
Fanzel was the instructor, right?
I don't know, Nick. I don't know anyone.
Fauna! Ah! Fauna! Okay. Anyway, he's reminded of Fauna with the third eye and stuff, but Finra's like, no, that can't be right. You know, this is Langris. This is my kid brother, you know. And, and Finra's like, you know what? Hey, you probably don't like it, but we're alike, aren't we? We may have different mothers, but even so, we are brothers. Gonna go into a rap there, man. Jeez. And he actually summons a whole bunch of orbs of spatial magic himself in order to counter Langris's ability. And Langris unleashes his assault, but Finral counters with his own. The two swarms of magic go towards each other. Langris is talking down to Finral, saying, hey, you threw away everything and left. You're a coward who can't even hurt people, so don't act like you're anybody's big brother. Huge explosion, and everyone reacts to it, and then you see the crystal that Finral was defending full of holes, and it crumbles apart. And then it cuts to Finral, and he's full of holes. Jesus Christ!
Looks pretty brutal there.
This is the most gruesome thing I think that we have seen in this whole series, and it is very effective. It actually kind of freaked me out a bit when I saw this, because, like, I mean, it's done the way that you would really expect. Like, parts of his body are just gone. He looks like freaking cheese now. It's disturbing. We cut over to where Leo, is fighting. He manages to, get the crystal But then Rice, he's like, yeah, we did it. You get the acknowledgement that their crystal has been destroyed, and they were just short on time. If they had been a little bit faster, then they would have destroyed the crystal before Langris. And so Leo is really hard on himself. He's like, God, I was so close. And then we cut over to Langris, and Langris is like, ha, now there's nothing that you can beat me at. Ugh.
But, I'm beating you and having more holes in my chest. Damn it!
You, I'm gonna have more holes in my chest now.
Yeah. It's like, wait, man, shit. You're stupid.
But we get a flashback from Langris's perspective that kind of fills in some of the holes in the flashback that we got last time, where he kind of just like observes some of the women around the mansion, kind of chatting and being like, oh, you know, young Master Findral is so kind and friendly and he's so popular. And yeah, young Master Langris is, he kind of, you know, looks down on people like a jackass, doesn't he? Yeah.
He's kind of an enormous tool.
And, it turns out that, the conversation that he overheard that Finral and, their fiance were having, like, Langris was actually affected by that. You'd think, like, even she thinks that about Finral. So, in terms of, there's nothing you can beat me at, turns out the whole being nice and being able to get along with people was actually one of the things that Langris was resentful for him towards, because Langris might be a bit insane, probably from growing up in such a messed up fucking household.
I don't see that, Nick. Seems like he had a pretty okay life to me.
I mean, he's not full of holes, so clearly he couldn't have had that bad a childhood. just to drive it even further home, apparently he even resented the fact that Finral was trying to be nice to him when they were kids too, because Finral popped in and was like, hey, you know, stop trying to, you know, work so hard all the time. Come play with your big brother for a little bit. And Langris is just like, why is he nice to me too? So it's one of those weird things where I kind of get it, but it's really hard to explain in words, like the reason why he resents him for being nice. It's almost as if he's kind of rubbing it in his face, the thing that people care like about him more than they like about Langris. So
I think it's also an element of like kind of control that he had before, where he's like, I'm the superior one to my big brother. I'm better than him in every way. And from that, he expects his brother to react a certain way. He'd expect him to be distraught over it, to be angry over it, to be like him, to be a bitter person. Mm-hmm. Instead, Finral consistently always was happy, was even being friendly to him. And he's just like, this isn't right. Why are you stop it. You should be angry. You should hate me. You should be jealous of me. Yeah.
And he is, now that they've actually won the competition, now Langris is standing over Finral and is raising up his arm, ready to finish him off. And he says, vanish. And immediately, Luck and Magna and Asa are all surrounding him. It's a really cool picture with the three of them with their melee attacks all at the ready held to his throat. And, even up on the, wall above them, Charmy's got her giant fluffy lamb thing at the ready as well. And Noelle is looking over Finral, and she's like, holy crap, he is going to die. all three of the guys surrounding, Langris say their various threats and stuff. I like Lux the most though, because he's just like, forget the match. We'll kill you.
Yeah.
Like, yes, proper response. But Langris doesn't even seem to be intimidated, because he's just like, you're just a bunch of idiots from the Black Bulls. I'm the vice captain of the Golden Dawn. What the hell do you think you're going to do? But then the Wizard King drops down and he's like, hey, chill.
He's like, hey, buddy, go fuck yourself. How about that?
And he says specifically, those who go easy on their companions in a fight can't be trusted, but those who try to kill their companions have problems that run much deeper than trust. Yes, like psychosis. So, fortunately, a medical mage who is with him goes to start working on Finral, and hopefully he's going to be okay. Gotta find out, he's gotta live long enough that we can find out what color his hair is so that Annalise can cosplay as him.
Wow.
That may sound like I'm not being sensitive to all this, but whatever. You know. And Asta really stands up for Finral, starts chewing Langris out for what he's done and says, Mr. Finral's nicer than anybody. He's a true magic knight. No matter how tough you are no magic knight. And, so Langris just like, all right, you're for a newbie. You sure talk big. All right. Hey, Wizard King, let me fight these guys. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to fight him right now. And, he, of course, throws his spatial magic at Asta, and Asta's like, magic canceling sword!
He's like, ah, fuck you, alright.
Yeah, I can do that after the two matches you saw me in, didn't you? So everyone's like, hey, you know, something's wrong here. Like, Langris is really acting bizarrely right now. Hey, can we get him to, like, move his hair up a little bit? Can you check to see if there's a third eye under there or something? And one of the Wizard King's assistants is like, hey, aren't you gonna, like, stop him or something? And, he's like, in actual combat, there is no one to say stop or begin. So, you know, that's what I'm at. This seems a little reckless, but okay. Let them fight. Let them. So Asta and Langris are gonna fight now. Okay.
I guess I just like this idea of everyone being like, Langris is evil, but he belongs to the reputable group led by William Vengeance. How can he turn out to be evil?
Cut to William Vengeance, like, playing with some orphans.
Or conversely, pushing dogs down hills. Just like, that guy, like, turns the camera at that point. He's like, me?
Evil? Conversely? What are you talking about?
It's like the alternative way.
That seems like a swell guy right there.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. You hate dogs. I forgot for a moment.
It's one of my defining characteristics on the podcast, Chris.
That is true.
But, it was a very exciting chapter. Really, really intense and, suddenly gruesome, injury to Finral, but it looks like he's probably going to be mostly okay, but who knows? Parts of his body are gone. I guess it's just lucky that it seems as though, you know, it doesn't seem like parts of his head or parts of his head near his brain are missing.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I guess, yeah, of all the, you know, you hurt my friend, so I'm gonna hurt you bits that Asta has gotten in the series, this is one that I'm actually, like, into, because, we had the one that we had, the confrontation that Finral and Langris had going into this was really interesting and intense, and the fact that he went so far over the edge seems like the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, Asta, you kicked that asshole's ass. Dude, yeah, so.
I dig it. I like also just, like, I don't know, it feels like there is real more emotion here, maybe because it's not just Asta, but all the Black Bulls were, like, showing, like, the intention of, like, killing Langris in that moment. So it feels like everyone in the Black Bulls is kind of on this side. So I think that helps a little bit.
Mm. Okay. One Piece, chapter 880, Zero Escape. One little note I want to make here is, you know, we've been cutting around in the cover pages of the last several months to see what the, you know, subordinates of the Straw Hats are getting up to in all this time. And the one that we're following right now is Sai, who just had to break it to, you know, that woman he was betrothed to that, oh yeah, so me and Baby Five are going to get married. And she beat him up on the last page. And apparently she's upset because she was going to make him her 26th husband. And she has a club, a disco club called the Husband Club.
Yeah.
Hey.
Why? What else would it be called, Nick?
Husband Club. So does that mean you have to be? Does that mean you have to be one for husbands to get into the club? Is that, yes, why Don Jinjiao was so intent on Sai marrying her?
Obviously, it's an
exclusive. You're going into that club, yo.
I want to be able to dance.
Gotta get, like,
I'm old! I need my peanuts!
What's with this giant head of mine? Okay, so, Pudding and the rest show up in Chocolat Town. She pretends to everyone that she has taken Chiffon prisoner, kind of, so that she will help him in making the wedding cake again. Of course, this is all just their cover plan so that they can sneak them and Sanji in to do it. Then they bring in the 31 Whole Cake Island chefs to help them out. They lure them into the factory one at a time, or she demands that they each come in. Hey, you know, come in one at a time so that she can modify their memory so that they think it's perfectly natural that Sanji is there and helping them as opposed to, you know, should be on the run from them and will report his presence and get him arrested and stuff. Then we get a bit of jokes during their preparations to actually set about making the cake. There's a cool little bit where Sanji shows up. What an awesome chef he is, that he immediately knows what the hell the ingredients for the cake are. He just remembers everything. And Chiffon's like, how the hell do you know all of these things? Not only did you memorize the shape, but you know all the ingredients. And Sanji's like, huh, I figured it out by the scent. I'm an awesome chef.
He's like, that's what I do. I'm amazing.
It's also amazing that he's got such a great sense of smell when he's smoking all the time.
Nick, please.
Stop it, Sanji. You're going to die young.
Keep doing it, Sanji. It makes you look cool.
You're a manga character. You won't actually get sick and die.
Yeah.
Pudding shows up in her chef, outfit. And honestly, I'm going to be fully honest. I literally saw this panel and I was like, oh, she looks quite cute with her big old chef hat. But Sanji's just like, oh, she's so cute in the chef's outfit. And of course, Pudding's going to be like, ah, you complimented me. They go over the fact that, oh yeah, the chefs will help us out. They believe the story that I have, that you're here to help me. All the chefs actually are just like, yeah, you were actually, you know, correct when you made this blueprint for this cake. So yes, let's do this thing. One of the chefs observes, like, huh, you know, who would have guessed that your first act as a married couple would be to bake a cake together? And Sanji's like, ah, yeah, I guess you're right. Shucks. But meanwhile, Pudding is blushing so hard that her head has caught on fire. I don't think I've ever seen that quite that visual gag used before. So she breaks out of it with one of her, like, ah, fuck you, I'm in love with you kind of things. But basically, the long and short of it is that Chiffon and Sanji and Pudding, with the assistance of the 31 head chefs, are going to make this cake together and prevent Big Mom from destroying the country as they do it. And so they set about doing that. We cut into the mirror world. Luffy is really not looking so good as he's continuing to fight against Katakuri. Katakuri, while he has a moment, says to Brulé, hey, you know, look, get going, because we can't move any soldiers without you moving around. So, look, go and, like, get some soldiers and set their ship on fire while I stop this guy. And so they're like, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And Luffy immediately tries to stop them. Oh, wait, actually, there's these guys that are obviously, like, part of the Long Neck tribe. Or siblings of theirs that Mama married some guy from the Long Neck tribe or something like that, who are bringing a mirror over. And Luffy tries to stop them. He launches a fist out, but he can't really focus on pursuing them in order to break the mirror because Katakuri's still there, beating the shit out of him over and over and over again. The Long Neck siblings do this weird thing where they cross their necks over each other in order to laugh at him. It's weird. Anyway, Luffy has to grab a shard of one of the mirrors in order to communicate with Nami and say, hey, you have to break all the mirrors on the ship because otherwise they're going to start coming in and destroying stuff and setting stuff on fire. And, Nami's like, but, you know, how are you going to get back? And Luffy just says, I don't know. I'll find a way, but you've got to do this. And yeah, things are pretty bad because, Brulé is working with the two Long Neck siblings to launch flaming arrows through one of the mirrors in order to set the ship on fire. Remember, of course, the Demonics have that archery specialty thing. Luffy tries to stop them. Katakuri kicks him.
Kicks him pretty hard.
Yeah. Luffy just says, like, look, just smash all the mirrors. They're going to pile through, and I can't stop them all myself because I need to focus on him. And Nami immediately orders everyone, hey, you know, we got to break all the mirrors. But Carrot cuts her off and says, there's no escape. Because in addition to Big Mom coming towards them on that, you know, wave of candy that Prospero summoned for her, she's used her powers to give life to the ocean. And a giant tidal wave is now about to crash down on them. Yay!
Well, that is terrifying.
It's even worse because it's grinning down at them.
Yeah, it's like, hey, I'm gonna eat that ship.
Well, so things are looking pretty dire for both Luffy and for Nami and company. At least things are going pretty well for Sanji right now.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, this cake is coming together. Nice.
Guys, I know most of you will drown and Luffy will be beaten to death, but take solace in the fact that this cake is going to be delicious.
it's going to be so sweet. You're going to be dead, but like if you were alive, you'd love it. It's a pretty exciting chapter though. Like this ending here is just so tense with everything happening on the ship and like the fire starting and Luffy's like trying to like save the ship so he could focus on just this fight with Katakuri, which he seems to be on the losing end of. It's really just like a tense situation all around. And, the final shot of that waterfall, that tidal wave is terrifying. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right. With all that done, let's do our favorites for this week. Favorite series and MVP. Chris.
So I'm going to give my chapter of the week to One Piece. I think that was a really fun chapter of One Piece. I didn't care for the two new siblings they introduced. It's one of those things of just like, look, I can only give a fuck about so many fucking mom's children before they start falling apart and like mixing together. But I love that this fight with Katakuri is still going on. I love how tense everything was getting towards the end. I also really like the way Pudding and Sanji are like interacting. It's sort of like that Twice dichotomy where it's like somebody who in one moment will say like, I love you. And next moment be like, oh, fuck yourself. Like, I like how there's one moment where she's thinking about how much she loves him. Like the next panel, she's flipping him off. Like, go fuck yourself. You know, it's just an amusing way to go around. And again, I really like the notion that Sanji's cooking is actually going to be a very vital point to ending this arc about Sanji, you know?
My favorite series this week was Black Clover. I really liked the just utter brutality of what happened with Fenrir and Langrisse. And I thought that it was actually a really cool little stare down that he had with the three Black Bulls at the end. And just the whole, yeah, all right, there's actually an Asta fight that I'm kind of looking forward to seeing unfold. So, MVP for this week, I'm going to give to Asumi for throwing a monkey wrench into things and just being a different kind of character and we never learn that changes the dynamic and acts differently from basically every female character we've seen in this series so far, which I appreciate.
And I'm going to give my MVP to Sir Nighteye for sticking up for Mirio the entire time and just like having a kind of cool way of doing things here, even though seems like he may be suffering as a result. It's a good way to show off being a mentor.
Yeah. I considered doing it for now. I mean, you know, dude almost had his arm ripped off, so. okay, that is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. We thank you guys for joining us. We tend to record the show around 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, assuming that tech issues don't assail us. Hitbox.tv. Smashcast.tv/RoloT and Twitch.tv/RoloT are the places where you can see us. If things tend to change, like if we need to reschedule or something like that, you can follow us on social media to stay updated. At WMR Podcast is usually where we'll put that stuff. That's the official account for the show. And you can also follow your hosts individually at RoloT and at YRulerOfTime. Also, be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com as well as on YouTube and iTunes. If you check us out on those then be sure to subscribe, leave a comment, leave a rating. If you do that on iTunes, it'll help us to climb to the top of the hobby podcast and defeat the woodworkers.
Yes. I had all that stuff open, by the way, ahead of time to give like special thanks and everything, but because of four crashes, I haven't gotten to it yet. So I will give that all next week. I apologize.
And if you need to send us feedback or ask us questions or make suggestions in the comments, then you can do that by sending that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. And keep in mind that we are still looking for Halloween recommendations. I've got one already picked out for next week, but we're going to need to do two more. So keep those coming, guys. There's a chance that we may still see it and may still select it in one of the future weeks, because I'm pretty sure that this recommendation that we're going to be doing is only going to take us 1 week. I'll go ahead and go over it now. It is called Fort of Apocalypse.
That's a pretty cramped name.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It's about a zombie apocalypse, but with a twist that it focuses on four inmates at a junior asylum thing. What do you call that? What is that called?
Mental institution?
No, not a mental institution. Just like prison. Oh gosh, what's that called? Anyway, kids in jail, basically.
Oh, JV, like juvie?
Juvie, yes. Juvenile Detention Center. That was it. I don't know why I went for junior. Juvenile Detention Center, focusing on them because they're in this prison. They are kind of able to escape the first waves of the zombie apocalypse, and it's about them trying to survive. Might be a little bit High School of the Dead, but we'll see. Special thanks go out to all of our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. Last week, you guys will remember that we wrapped up Sadistic September by talking about The Prince of Tennis, and if you want, you can check out a special bonus episode that I recorded by myself about rules violations in that series. It's available completely for free. You don't even need to be a patron to see it. So go check that out if you have any interest in hearing me talk about tennis rules. I'm sure all of you do.
I imagine so, right? Why wouldn't they?
Yeah. And lastly, special thanks go out to Steve Marrow Tower Cards. You can check out his work in a number of different areas, including his own Patreon. Be aware that he draws lots of NSFW stuff, but you can also see all of the tile cards that he has done for us on his Patreon. And Infamous Planet as well. Thank you for helping us to put this frame together and everything like that. This frame that contains, instead of Chris, Oogie Boogie.
Yes. But I am Oogie Boogie today.
Yes.
And I think that's going to do it then, right?
Yeah, that's everything.
Got everything there. Got all the spooky stuff out of the way for this episode. I hope it wasn't too spooky for anybody, but, you know, we can't always control that.
I mean,
also,
yes, we can.
Did we do the sponsor for this week? This episode, by the way, guys, was sponsored by the letter B for
what?
Boo and bones and spooky bats and also for badgers. Those aren't inherently spooky, but it does stand for other things than just spooky words.
I never thought that Hufflepuff was spooky. I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, it did have Neville Longbottom in it.
No, it didn't. He was Gryffindor.
I don't fucking know. All right, I don't know your nerdy Harry Potter series, Nick.
You could have just as easily gone for the house ghost.
I don't know who the fuck the house ghost is for them.
It's the Fat Friar.
All right, well, maybe next week we'll just do a nerdy fucking Harry Potter trivia show for Nick, and I'll just stand in the back and find boo-based pun nicknames for everybody.
Go find my Harry Potter Trivial Pursuit game.
You're a fucking loser.
He said on the podcast that they hosted together to talk about manga.
Yes. Yes, I did. I'm aware of the irony.